So we're here today with Professor Austin Sarrett. Austin is the William Nelson Professor Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science, and also Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought, also Associate Dean of the Faculty here at Amherst College. He's just published a new book in collaboration with students called Gruesome Spectacles, Botched Executions and America's Death Penalty. My name is Martha Umphrey. I'm a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought here at the college, and I'm here to talk with Austin about his wonderful new book, which made quite a bit of a splash when it first came out. Austin,
thank you, Martha.
It's nice to be with you, Austin. Austin, one of the things the book says is that botched executions are an important part of the story of capital punishment, and I wonder whether you could talk about what you think they really tell about that story.
Right, so the story of capital punishment in the United States is interwoven very closely with an American idea that punishment should not be cruel. And the story of capital punishment in the United States has depended upon the ability of capital punishment to satisfy this Eighth Amendment standard. Botched executions remind us of the precariousness of the relationship between capital punishment in general and the Eighth Amendment standard of cruelty in particular. Second thing that I think they tell us is they tell us that the capital punishment is, in the last analysis, about technology and the capacity of a technology, whether it be hanging or electrocution or lethal gas or lethal injection, to work safely, reliably, efficiently, and humanely. The third thing that I think that the analysis of botched executions tell us in the story of capital punishment is that there is no such thing as a perfectible death penalty. That error is always part of the story of capital punishment. So those are the three things that I think an analysis of botched executions contributes to an understanding of the story of capital punishment in the United States.
And when you talk about the imperfectibility of capital punishment and talk about error, could you talk about that a little bit in relation to the idea of cruelty? What is it that distinguishes a good execution from a cruel execution from the point of view of error? What kinds of errors are you talking about when you talk about that?
So cruelty can be understood in a variety of ways. So one way to understand cruelty is cruelty has to do with the intensity of pain suffered. So a punishment is cruel if it imposes an intense amount of pain. Another way to understand cruelty doesn't focus quite as much on the intensity of the pain, but focuses on the question of whether the pain imposed is excessive or more pain than is necessary. The constitutional standard is that an execution is cruel if it imposes more pain than is necessary, if it imposes some excess of pain, if it amounts to something more than the mere extinguishment of life. So in a sense, the constitutional commitment is to get the condemned from life to death in a way that imposes, again to use the phrase, no more pain than is necessary. And many, but not all, botched executions fail that test. They impose more pain than is necessary. Now, perhaps to understand that, we have to understand what a botched execution is. So in the book, we define a botched execution as an execution that does not conform to the legal protocol, which is supposed to govern an execution, or does not conform to standard operating procedure. So the definition that we use in the book is, I would say, neutral. It simply says, here's what an execution is supposed to look like. Here's what's supposed to happen in an execution. Now let's look at the executions that we've had and see whether or not they conform to what it is that we're supposed to, they're supposed to be. I can't say that every botched execution amounts to an imposition of pain that is more than is necessary. Because some of the botched executions that we document, they don't involve the imposition of pain, but they involve the protocol. So, for example, a lethal injection, which takes a very long time, is a botched execution, even if that botched execution, even if that long period of time, doesn't impose an excessive amount of pain. So the story of botched executions and its relationship to cruelty kind of depends upon which of these definitions that you use of cruelty, whether or not it's the very intensity of pain, or whether it's not it's something that's excessive, or whether or not it's something that's unnecessary.
Right.
There's a wonderful Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision called Campbell versus Wood, in which the question was whether hanging was unconstitutionally cruel. Hanging was the method of choice in the state of Washington at the time that this case was decided. And the majority opinion said, no, hanging was not unconstitutionally cruel if done according to the Army Field Manual. There was nothing inherently wrong with hanging. The dissenting opinion said, hanging, even if done well, violates the evolving standards of decency of a humane society. And that suggests there's a kind of fourth understanding of cruelty, which has less to do with the pain imposed than some idea of human dignity, what a dignified death or a decent death what it entails.
Yeah.
So that, and that idea about evolving standards of decency or human dignity is part of the Eighth Amendment tradition, and sometimes, I wouldn't say often, but sometimes brought to bear in saying that this or that execution violates the Eighth Amendment.
Right, that makes a lot of sense, and partly the argument of the book is that that evolving standard is connected with technological change. And in a sense, you could tell that story as a story of progress, that we've moved from, as your book details, hanging to electrocution to lethal gas to lethal injection, all in the hope that we're achieving a higher standard of civilized behavior in relation to capital punishment, that we're interested in pain reduction, we're interested in greater dignity and the like. So there's a possibility of telling the story of capital punishment generally is a story of progress. You resist that in this book, and I wonder if you could talk about why you don't really buy that story of progress.
So let me just say a little bit about the story of progress and then why I don't buy the story. So I would say that the legitimacy of capital punishment in the United States depends upon the idea that we can find a method of execution which comports with our commitment that no punishment should be cruel. Or to put it differently, that the legitimacy of capital punishment in the United States depends upon an idea of technological or scientific progress. That technology or science is going to solve this conundrum, which is we want to punish, but we don't want to punish cruelly. And I think one of the contributions of the book, or contribution I hope the book makes, is to making that story and that dependence visible. The dependence of capital punishment on this idea of scientific progress. And by the way, that story, that idea of scientific progress or technological progress, is, as is widely known, an important American story. It's an important story that we believe about a lot of things, that science or technology will resolve social, cultural, or legal problems. So why don't I buy that story? I don't buy that story in part because the same promises that were made in 1977 in the state of Oklahoma, when the state of Oklahoma adopted lethal injection as the legally acceptable method of execution in Oklahoma, namely that lethal injection would be safe, reliable, and humane, those same promises were made in Nevada in the 1920s when Nevada adopted the gas chamber as its method of execution. And those same promises were made in 1890 in the state of New York when the state of New York became the first of all the American states to adopt the electric chair as its method of execution. So I think that the facts, at least with respect to the death penalty, belie the story. And so instead of a linear story of progress, oh look, we've gone from this to that to the next, look at how much better off we are, I think the story is a kind of circular one and a repeated one in which the illusion that we're going to find a method of execution which is safe, reliable, and humane is sustained by this linear progress narrative, and I hope what the book shows is how the story of capital punishment in the United States from 1890 to 2010, the period that we cover, is more cyclical than it is linear. And I've always wanted to say the phrase more secular than linear. So I feel very good about that. Thank you for the opportunity.
Time is a circle, not a line. One possible line that you do detail in the book, though, is a shift that other scholars have noted, too, a shift from capital punishment as a public spectacle toward the privatization of capital punishment with the inside prison walls, with many fewer witnesses under highly controlled conditions. And a lot of what you do talk about in the book, in addition to the ways in which courts think about executions generally and botched executions in particular, is the public response to both capital punishment and botched executions. I wonder if you could talk about the significance of that increased privatization in the story of legitimation that I think you're telling. Legitimacy of capital punishment remains the case in this country. And talk about why, what difference it makes that these executions are not really publicly displayed anymore.
Right. So I think the argument about the movement from public to private execution is a well-traveled path in scholarship. I think it's widely known, and I'm not sure that the book that I've written adds a whole lot to it. So let me just rehearse a little bit about what I understand that story to be. We depend on it. I don't know that we add to it. So generally, what is said is that the movement from public to more private executions is linked to changing sensibility of the American bourgeoisie. The last public execution occurred in Kentucky in 1935. It was a hanging. So many scholars believe that this increased privatization of capital punishment is a way in which middle class sensibilities could be satisfied. In the 19th century, we used to die at home. We now die in hospitals. Again, part of the story of we don't want to see the body and its gruesomeness displayed before us. There's a subsidiary argument that's made, and I take it seriously, and that is that part of this, if you allow me to say it, domestication of capital punishment as it's moved from private to from public to private, is that we want capital punishment to appear to be merely administrative, that we want it to appear to be merely technical, we want it to appear to be not some grand ritual anymore, but merely, if you will, the last act in a process which is thoroughly bureaucratized. The scholar Michel Foucault, in one of his many writings, talked about how the scene of capital punishment had moved from the scaffold to the trial. And I think that's right. And this privatization of the execution scene itself, I think, is part of that movement. So there isn't, people who've witnessed lethal injections have said there's nothing to see. And that removal of the site of the state's awesome power of working its will, if you will, on the body of the condemned is in addition to this appeal to middle-class bourgeois sensibilities. We don't have to see the gruesomeness. Part of the transformation of punishment from grand spectacle to mere administrative act.
Right.
May I just say one other thing about this?
Sure.
So, what does the book say about botched executions? It says that over the period from 1890 to 2010, approximately 3% of America's executions were botched. And it shows that in the period from 1982 to 2010, 1982 was the first use of lethal injection in Texas, that 7% of lethal injections have been botched. So part of the contribution of the book is, and this really reverts to the first question you asked, merely to document the incidents in which mishaps occur at the scene of execution. Now, why do I say that here? I say it because it may very well be, though I don't think this is a matter of intention, that the privatization of execution serves to hide the pervasive reality of botched executions from public view. That's more apparent than ever today in the United States, when state after state now has made their execution protocols secret. And in almost every botched execution that I know of in the modern period, when things begin to go wrong, the curtains get drawn. Mm-hmm. The witnesses are prevented from seeing the execution from beginning to end when the botching is actually happening. So it may very well be that the privatization of execution has the side benefit of ensuring that when things go wrong, that the public is going to have no direct access to it. And the recent controversies about the botched executions that have occurred in the United States in this year, I think, make that all the more apparent in terms of the importance of botched execution to the public dialogue about capital punishment. And just one more thing in this soliloquy. Is it a soliloquy or a monologue?
I'd probably call that a monologue.
Okay, one more thing in this monologue, and that is, I wouldn't want anybody to think that the book that I've written is sensational. In every chapter of the book where we examine a method of execution and the kinds of things that go wrong, we tell as much about the criminal and his crime, the background of that criminal, the trial, as we do about what went wrong in the scene of execution itself. And I think that's important to what it is that we were trying to do. I mean, what we were trying to do was, in the first instance, to produce an archive of botched executions. We chose a definition of botched executions which was as neutral as we could, make it. And as your very adept and acute question noted right at the beginning, this is a book as much about the myth of progress in the United States and how it's played out in the debate and the life, if you will, of capital punishment in the 20th century as it is about anything else.
That's so interesting. It's as if, you know, the gesture is to pull the curtain back again, to look at the details behind these botched executions, the cases, the people. And I was struck when I was reading the book and its various chapters, which follow this sort of so-called progress of techniques of execution, by the kinds of detail that you chose to put in the book. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. I mean, we often get an account of the last meal. We get an account of the crime. Was there a particular reason that you really were invested in providing some case studies, as it were, of these botched executions? You certainly don't detail all of them. I mean, you have a very detailed appendix at the end of the book that describes, in brief, every botched execution in your archive. You focus on a few of them. What role does detail play in the kinds of work you're trying to do?
Right. So each chapter, except the first and the last, the central chapters of the book, are organized by the method of execution. So first hanging, and then the electric chair, and then gas, and then a lethal injection. What we wanted to do is we wanted to tell the characteristic ways in which each of those method of executions has been botched. So what are the typical ways that when something goes wrong in a hanging or an electrocution, that it goes wrong? And then we chose, I would say, a more narrative than a more social science form, because we wanted to give life to the people whose crimes brought them to this point, to a death penalty, and whose fate was to have their executions go wrong. We wanted to give a human context to what seems to be a largely technological failure. It's good that you pick up on this question of detail because of what I just said a minute ago. We were very conscious about not wanting to present a book that would merely be sensational. So in some ways, the story of the botching of the execution in almost every case is much briefer and shorter and less detailed than the broader context of who the criminal was, what the crime was, and what the trial was. And the last thing that I would say is that botched executions are part of a process in which crimes are committed, prosecutions are made, judgments are reached, sentences are imposed. And we wanted to keep in front of the reader that process. So that's why we made the choices that we made. What are the exemplary ways, or what are the typical ways in which these kinds of technologies go wrong? And then what we tried to do is to pick out from our archive what we thought was the richest, most complicated, most subtle example of each of the ways that we said were the exemplary botchings that would occur for each of the methods of execution. And I should note one thing which readers might note. Over the course of the time that we examined capital punishment from 1890 to 2010, there were 34 executions by firing squad. By our understanding, none of them were botched. So we didn't write a chapter on botched firing squads because we didn't have anything to say about them. Does that mean I think the firing squad is the best method of execution? No, I don't, because of what I said earlier about the different ways in which we understand cruelty. And it may be that a firing squad doesn't impose any excessive pain, but it may be that the firing squad is incompatible with the evolving standards of decency of a humane society or the dignity that we seek to accord people when we punish them.
So let me pick up on that a little bit, because as I was reading through the book, I was thinking to myself, well, if I had to choose a method of execution, and realizing that there were a couple not in the book that are fail-safe enough that maybe you didn't have the evidence to include them, or they haven't been used in the United States. Firing squad was one of them that struck me. The other is obviously on the minds of many people, the beheading or the guillotine. And the guillotine is used as an example in one of the cases that you talk about. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Provenzano versus Moore, which is a 1999 case. And as an example of a fail-safe method of execution, I don't think you could come up with a better one. And yet the judge in that case said that beheading or the guillotine would be considered violative of the Eighth Amendment not because of the imposition of pain so much, but because of the audience, the ways in which audiences would understand what cruelty is by, in a sense, absorbing it themselves. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. It's a slightly different sort of refinement of the idea of cruelty, and I'd like to make a bridge between that point and the emphasis the book lays on cultural reception,
mm-hmm.
and in particular the ways that newspapers have or have not picked up on the important parts of the botched execution process that I think your book is trying to do when you say it's trying to humanize these cases.
Right. So punishment demands an audience. Without an audience, punishment has no meaning. And in essence, your question about the guillotine, and I must say, I'm not really comfortable with that question, and I'll tell you why. But in a sense, your question about the guillotine returns us to the conversation we were having about public and private execution. The same concern about sensibility. David Garland, who's a law professor and a sociologist at New York University, very interested in what he calls the pedagogical impact or the communicative value of punishment to its audiences. And again, some of this is familiar and people will know this, that there's some worry that the sight of violence incites violence. I think with respect to the guillotine, the same concern is expressed as was expressed in the dissenting opinion by Judge Reinhardt in the Campbell versus Wood case that I mentioned earlier, that it's an indecent way of killing, that the severing of the head from the body offends against some deep cultural understandings of a kind of respect for human dignity, even in its last instances. Now, you might ask me, well, Austin, why don't you like the question about the guillotine? This is typical academic fodder, asking oneself a question so that one can speak at greater length about what you want to.
Let me ask you a question. Why don't you like the question about the guillotine?
I don't like the question about the guillotine because I published 3 books. This is the 3rd book in a kind of trilogy about capital punishment. I've edited many others about capital punishment. In all of that work, I'm interested in the following. I'm interested in inviting my readers to focus on the death penalty that we have, not the death penalty that we might imagine or the death penalty that we might desire. So the question about the guillotine is, to the world of botched execution, what the Hitler hypothetical is to the world of the death penalty in general. So if you're against the death penalty, someone is sure to say, do you mean you wouldn't have executed Hitler? And the guillotine question feels to me that it resonates a little bit that way on technology. And you're right, it's raised in case law, but it's not talking about the death penalty that we have. And that's what I think we ought to do. When Judge Kozinski, the Ninth Circuit, a couple months ago, denounced lethal injection and talked about how, well, we ought to go back to death by the firing squad, he was talking about the death penalty that we have and imagining, if you will, an older technology. And what he said is what I think is central to capital punishment. He made a lot of headlines by talking about how we ought to go back to the firing squad. But what didn't make headlines is what he said, which is the death penalty is always brutal. And that's why I want to talk about the death penalty that we have, not about some technology that was used in France and rejected, or some technology that might be. I mean, I get lots of email. I wrote a book about white collar crime many years ago, I got lots of email from people who are interested in some advice about white-collar crime.
I bet.
I wrote a book about divorce. I got lots of email from people asking me about advice about divorce. With this book, I've gotten lots of email about people who have this or that preferred technology.
Right.
Couldn't we use this or couldn't we use that? And my answer is always the same, which is, that's an interesting question, but really not the one that I'm interested in. Let's talk about the death penalty that we have. Let's come to terms with the death penalty that we have. Let's see whether or not the death penalty that we have meets our own highest standards. And then when we've had that conversation, maybe we can have another conversation about some other technology.
That raises in my mind the interesting distinction that you make in the near the end of the book between perceiving a botched execution as a misfortune and understanding it as an injustice.
Right.
And that really is a question of the legitimacy of both the execution technologies that we use generally and the specific instances where they go wrong.
Yeah.
I wonder how we might recognize a botched execution as an injustice and whether we might then take the further leap to think about capital punishment itself as an injustice as opposed to a misfortune in either direction.
So the book ends, as you noted earlier, this is a book that's interested in the cultural life of capital punishment, the cultural life of botched executions. It ends by examining the coverage of botched executions in newspapers over the course of the 20th century. And as you note, we argue that newspapers have treated botched executions typically as misfortunes rather than injustices. And by a misfortune, we mean an event for which there is no blameworthy agent. An injustice is an event for which there is a blameworthy agent. So part of the argument I would make is that to see botched executions as injustices, you have to see the pattern. An agent becomes blameworthy when she ignores a set of circumstances or a pattern that could be altered. Mm-hmm. An agent becomes blameworthy when she limits her field of vision so as not to see the pattern. Mm-hmm. An airbag explodes and it sends shrapnel into the passenger of the car. We only see one of them. You might say, oh, that's an accident. But if we broaden our field of vision and we see more than one, dozens or hundreds, we say, ah, there's a pattern here. And so the work of the book in demonstrating that 3% of all American executions have been botched is to help readers see a pattern and to raise the question about whether or not what looks like it's merely accidental in this instance should really be seen as something which needs to be attended to. You know, there's a large question. Are 3% error rate unacceptable error rate in botched executions?
Right.
And that's a question that we're trying to raise. As you know, the book advances no normative argument.
That's right.
About either botched executions or about the death penalty itself. This is not an anti-death penalty book. It doesn't conclude, well, we ought to get rid of the death penalty. So by focusing on the pattern, what we want to do is open up the field of vision such that in seeing the pattern, we might say, well, actually, there is blame here. There is human agency here. And that human agency involves the answer to the question. 3%, is that an acceptable error rate for America's death penalty system.
Or seven, as you point out.
Well, seven for lethal for the most recent technology, lethal injection. And that, just to be clear, we stopped with 2010. So 7% doesn't include the most recent series of botched lethal injections.
Yep.
So the error rate might be higher than we documented for lethal injections.
Right. So in a sense, the project is trying to provoke a thoughtful response to a problem that hasn't been made visible, highly visible, in a way that goes beyond the history of the newspaper coverage you've told, which is a history that moves from kind of sensationalism on the one hand to the idea of balance and a sort of draining out of detail on the other.
Yes, that's exactly right. And there's a way, and when we were writing the book, we worried a little bit that our readers would think we were in favor of sensationalism and against balance. And there's a way in which we are in favor of sensationalism as against balance, because at least the sensational reporting tried to make visible actually what was going on. It tried, if you will, not to mute it. So I think you've captured the spirit of the book. I think you really have captured the spirit of the book. What do we know about capital punishment in the United States today? We know that there's been an enormous amount of focus on the problem of innocence. The errors that are made in determining who's guilty of a capital crime, tremendously important to the way in which we think about the death penalty. We know that a lot of attention has been paid to arbitrariness in sentencing, to the effect of the race of the victim, to the effect of the competence of the lawyers and the resources that can be brought to bear. This book adds another part of the story. So we focused on errors in guilt determination. We focused on errors in the imposition of the sentence. This book now adds to that by looking at errors in the carrying out of the sentence, and offers readers a chance to go beyond the first two, really to capture the third as well. And in a way, the book is either aptly timed or comes too late. So at the time that we were writing the book, no one much cared about botched executions. You know, because you were there, you were kind enough to invite me to give a talk to an Amherst Today event on privacy. And you generously introduced me and mentioned that I had just published this book. And at the time I quipped how if you wanted to sell books or get attention for books, you would never write a book on botched executions. You'd write a book on privacy. Do you remember that?
Yeah, very well.
And then, lo and behold, Oklahoma happened.
Right.
So the thing that we were trying to surface in the book, lo and behold, got surfaced in response to the Oklahoma execution.
Right.
So now you might say, well, Austin, that sounds like a sad story of your book, because you're saying it was kind of unnecessary. Well, it was unnecessary in the sense of galvanizing the attention of people to botched execution. I hope it's still necessary in documenting the repeated patterns that we were talking about earlier, and I hope people will realize that it makes a wonderful holiday giving.
I'm sure they will. Before we wrap up, let me ask you one more question. You have often used the pronoun we in this interview, and I know that you did this book in collaboration with some students as part of a curricular project on campus. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, and in particular if you could talk about the ways in which the project had effects on your students beyond, as I know from them, giving them some nightmares. But what effects did the project have on your students, and how do you think about your own scholarship now in relation to the work you've done and continue to do on capital punishment, having done this book with them?
So for a very long time, Amherst has afforded students the opportunity to work with faculty in the sciences. And I use the word with, not for. To collaborate with faculty on important experimental work, to write with faculty, that's a very common experience for undergraduates in the sciences at Amherst. Several years ago, the college approached the Mellon Foundation seeking support to develop a program to equip students to engage in collaborative research with faculty in the social sciences and the humanities. And over the last several years, I've participated in a set of what are called research tutorials, in which I've worked with students to develop their competence and their capacity to collaborate. My tutorial is called America's Death Penalty. In the first iteration of it, I offered students the opportunity to collaborate with me on this project on botched executions. And we wrote three articles, and we published this book together. You may know of others, but I know of no other book in the social science and humanities that's been jointly authored by a faculty member and undergraduates. Indeed, it's a little bit risky to do it. It's risky because people think undergraduates really don't have the capacity to do first-rate scholarship. After all, they're undergraduates. Mm-hmm. And if you collaborate with undergraduates on your work, then there must be something wrong with it. It can't be quite as good. I hope that the book helps to refute that or helps to mute that understanding. I hope that the thing stands for a kind of quality of scholarship and quality of work that people will say, oh my God, undergraduates can do that. Mm-hmm. The four undergraduates who were my co-authors on the book, Kate Bloomstein, Aubrey Jones, Maddie Sprung-Kaiser, and Heather Richard, were my collaborators in every sense of the word. We argued about interpretations. We wrote and rewrote together. What did they learn? Well, you know, it's hard for me to speak for them, so this is what I hope they learned. I hope they were moved more quickly than they might have otherwise been moved, from seeing themselves as students, as people who were absorbing knowledge, to understanding that they could make an independent contribution as scholars. I hope they learned both the extraordinary drudgery of scholarship and its extraordinary excitement. Mm-hmm. I hope they learned the rigors and discipline that make good scholarship, as well as the insight into the amount of creativity and imagination that's necessary to do scholarship. As for myself, I've been teaching for 40 years. When I came to Amherst, it was part of the ethos of the place that our undergraduates are as good as graduate students in their capacities. This is a kind of affirmation of that. It's, for me, an exciting new phase, opening up the next 40 years of possible collaborations. They're great collaborators. They're great collaborators in part. They were great collaborators in part because of what they knew, mm-hmm. and in part because of what they didn't know. They came to know a lot, indeed, it's certainly as much as I did and do about botched executions. Mm-hmm. But there were places where they were uninhibited by being burdened with the acceptable understandings of things. Mm-hmm. And that was completely thrilling when they would offer an interpretation or an argument which was so outside of the convention or so outside of what was available in the literature that I was taken aback. Now, I can't say that they prevailed in many of those arguments,
yeah.
But they prevailed in some. Since the Botched Executions Project, I've done another project with another group of undergraduates on death penalty films called Scenes of Executions. Mm-hmm. I'm currently involved with two other groups of undergraduates, one on a project on the coverage of the death penalty in the mainstream and the radical press in the 1970s, which was, of course, the high point of 20th century activism around the death penalty in the United States. Okay. And most recently, another historical project, I shouldn't say historical, I don't have a credential, another longitudinal project looking at the changes in the rhetoric of abolition in the United States over the course of the 20th century. This work has deepened my relationship with my students, mm-hmm. has expanded my relationship with my students, and has opened up for me a new imagining of myself as both a teacher and a scholar.
Well, it's tremendously exciting work, and I'm glad to hear there's more coming. Thank you for your time. Thank you for this wonderful book, and we'll look forward to seeing what comes next.
Thank you, Martha.